From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
In the Outer Sunset.
Suffolk Market.
Union City.
In the 69th Village.
Coming up, we'll get the latest news on the ghost ship warehouse fire in Oakland.
This is a devastating scene, and it is going to take us time to do the methodical, professional investigation that these families deserve.
Then we'll hear why the Bay Area attracts artists, like performer Melanie Green.
It's always been that very body of people that have made San Francisco a star on the map.
And we'll hear the story of one of the 19,000 people living in San Francisco's residential hotels.
I came from, you know, absolute poverty, and I try to be hopeful in spite of all that.
Heartbreak, resilience, and the stars that light this place up, next on Cross Currents. The city of Oakland is continuing to sort through the remains of the ghost ship, the warehouse in the Fruitvale district that burned down during a party on Friday night. 36 people have now been confirmed dead, with about a third of the building yet to be searched. Fire and law enforcement officials have been moving slowly in their search because they're worried the remaining walls of the building could collapse. KALW's Marissa Ortega-Welch was on the scene late this afternoon.
International Boulevard is closed between 30th Avenue all the way down to Fruitvale Avenue. So it's this main thoroughfare that goes right through the heart of the Fruitvale neighborhood. And it's completely closed except to media and first responders. There's an entire block that's just of news crew vans with media here from all over the world covering this fire. A criminal investigation has now been started, and so the warehouse is also now a crime scene. And so first responders are going to have to be mindful of that when they continue their recovery efforts. As has been reported many times, buckets and buckets of debris are being removed from the warehouse, and they're being taken away and are going to be analyzed by experts to understand how the fire happened, as well as to be used as evidence in the criminal investigation.
Over the weekend, Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf held a press conference to discuss how to move forward from one of the nation's deadliest fires in half a century.
This is a devastating scene. This is complicated, and it is going to take us time to do the methodical, thorough, and professional investigation that these families deserve to find out what in fact happened.
The Alameda County District Attorney and arson inspectors have begun an investigation. Several artists reportedly lived in the space that was not permitted for habitation, and the city had issued a citation last month. The tragic fire in Oakland has generated international coverage and plenty of social media expression from the Bay Area arts community. Artist Fabiana Rodriguez was born and raised in the Fruitvale, where the ghost ship warehouse is located. She's also the co-founder of an art space in East Oakland, the East Side Arts Alliance. Yesterday, Rodriguez wrote a Facebook post that both acknowledged the heartbreak of the tragedy, but also sought to rectify what she sees as an oversimplification of Oakland's art scene in news articles and opinion pieces. She spoke with KALW's Jen Chien earlier today from her studio in West Oakland.
After this horrible tragedy, there have been some calls for the city to shut down all underground and unlicensed art and live workspaces. What do you think of that idea? Is there a place for these kinds of places still in the arts ecosystem?
Absolutely. I mean, the beauty of Oakland is largely with its arts. I mean, since we had Mayor Dellums had identified that the arts was one of the most important places of growth for this city. It was one of the most important places of pride. And so to shut down venues is not the answer. On the contrary, is to think about how do we support and subsidize and make these venues even more accountable to the public. Right? Because if we have sufficient affordable artist housing, if we have dollars going so that every community gets the kind of artistic and cultural zones that it needs. And, you know, as someone living in Fruitvale, my community is neglected. It definitely, we don't have the roads that the Rock Ridge has. We have public infrastructure that's falling apart. So there's also needs to be a reprioritizing of our investment in public infrastructure and the arts is a part of that public infrastructure. By closing spaces, what we're doing is we're actually exacerbating the problem, because we're driving culture, we're driving it to the dark. As a cultural community, we need to bring up our standards of how we do, how we relate to each other.
So are you saying that artists need to self-regulate rather than having the city come in and try to bring things up to code?
When we see patterns of neglect, which were very evident to many people, that we shut them down, that we do not support them, that we encourage, you know, bands and people who come visit our city to adhere to basic principles, our values, right? Whether that's, you know, being anti-racist, making sure that your space is accessible to disabled people, making sure that queer folks and women don't get harassed, to making sure that you have a basic checklist. Why don't we ask basic fundamental questions around where the exits are? Do you have fire extinguishers? I mean, that should be part of our like ethical business practices as people who create cultural events. That should be part of our ethos.
I want to read something that you wrote on Facebook. And here's your quote. When community art spaces work hand in hand with the community, safety in its full form becomes a natural priority. Could you elaborate on that and then maybe talk about how that worked for you in Eastside Arts Alliance, which is the non-traditional art space that you co-founded in East Oakland?
We wanted to create a community space that the community fought for and that also would improve the development of our area, right? And that we wanted a safer Oakland, an Oakland with more jobs for us, for the people who had lived there for so many years. And so we spoke to partners in the community. We spoke to youth organizations, the immigrant rights groups, Black organizations, and we created a platform and a place to gather. And within a few years, we were able to get support from many non-arts groups, and we were eventually able to buy a building that was over $4 million and to have affordable housing. And so now this, the Eastside Arts Alliance has merged and is doing more and more projects around international, creating things like Black cultural zones, and always in consultation with the community. Because, you know, I think that the other aspect of things is that when people are looking for profit or when they're looking to just kind of create spaces where you can squeeze out every dollar, then safety does not become a priority because there's no accountability there. But if you're working with people to co-create a space and to have a bigger vision of the role that arts and culture can play in your life and how it can give you the ability to, you know, create your own music, to see a performance you may never have seen before, then naturally you want to create a space that's safe. I mean, you want to create a space that you can take your kids to. And I think that when we approach it in that way, then we become accountable to the public that we serve. And we are co-creating a community asset that won't be moved, that won't disappear. Right. And that also the community invests in and that has its own regenerative life.
What do you hope for? What do you hope for the city and for the arts community in the aftermath of this tragedy?
So I would like to see really a cultural change in how we address safety, an inclusion of safety, first of all, a very, you know, intentional inclusion of safety in all of its forms. I would like to see an empowerment of those who are most marginalized and those who mostly need the spaces, because there was a lot of trans and queer folks who died. There was a lot of young people of color who died. And it also points at the young, they need the space. People need a space to feel safe. So those people need to be empowered to control spaces, to manage spaces, to be at the head. And the third thing is that we need public infrastructure in this. In order to have a thriving and a safe arts community, the city needs to identify it as a priority and to understand that this is an investment in people, because culture is a human right, and culture is something that will just never lose its power, its light. And so the role that the city can play is rather than approach it through regulation and repression, you know, rather than the no, let's talk about the yes. Let's talk about what does the yes look like? Can we envision, you know, a corridor among International Boulevard, which is such a, you know, we have so many art spaces just in East Oakland. Can we imagine a corridor and a plan, a cultural plan for Oakland that is in the most marginalized section of our city? Right? And can we do that for West Oakland? Because downtown has plenty of art spaces. You know, so that's what I would like to see out of this is that is those three things.
That was Oakland artist Fabiana Rodriguez speaking with KALW's Jen Chien. So far, $290,000 have been raised by 2,200 people for the relief effort. The Oakland A's and Raiders have both pledged matching grants up to $50,000 each. We'll show you how to contribute at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. And thanks to Jeremy Dalmas and Holly J. McDeed for help with our coverage. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. When artist and curator Melanie Green and her twin sister moved to San Francisco 15 years ago, they made themselves an integral part of the arts community through art shows, public events, and even their own weekly radio show on KPOO. We'll go back to KALW's Jen Chien now. She spoke with Green about the power of artists to shape and sustain the culture of a city.
So this show that you've curated is called Black Matters.
Yes.
Can you dig a little into that title for me?
We wanted it to be very broad. We didn't want artists to feel that there was any kind of container that they had to express themselves from. We wanted them to know that however they identify Black issues, Black concerns, things that we just are, things that we care about and think about, or what impacts us. So leaving it at matters, having it be open, is really what we wanted to do with this particular show.
What about for you personally? What comes to mind for you with that phrase?
I think of love. And inside of love, sometimes there's pain and anger. There's disappointment. For me, it's all of those things. It's a body of expression. It's a matter of, you know, the depths of who I am, not just always showing up with a smile, but maybe showing up with tears and maybe showing up with things that people don't want to talk about. The work that's in the show is a reflection of that. There's a lot of different conversations, from being in hospice care to, you know, arms up. And the piece that Christine Mays created, All Wire, and it's full-bodied, you know, a person, like, arms stretched up with, you know, blood running. And this is, you know, work that might be tough for people to see. It might be confronting. But it's so. It's a reflection of life, you know.
The specific language in the promo materials for the show are an invitation to people of all backgrounds, mm-hmm. Black people, other people of color, and white people to look at Black Matters by Black artists from the Black perspective. Can you tell me more about that choice in terms of the language that's used? And does that come from the Afro Solo Project? And
yeah, within the Black community, and maybe I'll just speak for myself, it gets old having to kind of explain Black love, or, you know, validate Black love, or say just because I love myself doesn't mean I don't love you, you know? And when we begin
you're talking about
other communities,
uh-huh.
And
sort
in
of
particular
Black people explaining themselves to non-Black
to people. Non-Black people, and in particular to white culture. We wanted to be responsible and say, yes, this is explicitly about our experience, explicitly from Black artists. Please come.
So, Melanie, you're originally from Memphis,
yes,
Tennessee.
Yes.
And you and your twin sister, Melora, moved here about 15 years ago.
Yes, yeah. 16.
16
we
years
moved
ago.
Here in 2000, August.
So seemingly from the time you got here, you just immediately immersed yourselves into the arts community, mm-hmm. and really kind of started doing stuff.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to come here and stay here?
So the original plan, Academy of Art, now University, when we moved here, it was Academy of Art College. Academy of Art. And
you both were going to go there.
Yep. We both were going to attend the Academy of Art, graduate, and move to LA, start making film. Yay. And we fell in love with the community and started creating events like Bring Your Own Art, BYOA, and Independent Artist Week, and just finding so many ways that we can connect city organizations, nonprofits to the artist community. We really came in and said, there is a huge gap. There's a way that, you know, nonprofits can be empowered by the work that artists do, and encouraging artists to talk about themselves and talk about their work. And when you go into a space, don't just stay to you, really observe who's here. Who can I build with? How can I share my gift with their work and collaborate? You know, how do I make that happen? And I think the fact that Melora and I are twins, collaboration, how do I link with someone or teaming up and connecting is like an automatic thing for us.
It seems to me like the kind of narrative of how you and your sister came here mm-hmm. and started to make connections amongst the people who were already here, already doing things. You didn't try to kind of reinvent the wheel with what you were doing, but kind of dug in to what was already happening. That's a different style of newcomers moving into a place than a mm-hmm. narrative that we hear often about gentrification.
Yes.
It's a hot button word these days about mm-hmm. people coming in and not respecting the culture that had existed before. Does that resonate with you?
It resonates with me in a huge way because we were intentional about integrating with systems that are already present. Like, that's already here. How do we bring this together? And I think that's something that we learned from the film festival. That's all film is. Everyone doing their part really, really well and not concerned with the other pieces, so you trust the process. And so we get away from that when there's this idea that I can be the lone hero. You know, I want to be the one to carry the torch and ride all the way in and put it down and say, I did it. And a lot of times when that is the driving force, you can bet that there's like 100 people pissed around you because I bet you didn't listen. I bet you didn't ask questions. So that's the thing. Ask. And sometimes just come in and be quiet and just look around. See what's going on.
That was artist, curator, and public programmer Melanie Green speaking with KALW's Jen Chien. You can see the multimedia show Melanie curated called Black Matters, part of the 22nd annual Afro Solo Arts Festival at the San Francisco Public Library's main branch through December 15th. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. The Oakland Warehouse Fire focused our attention on marginal living spaces, places where habitability upgrades often, unfortunately, result in displacement. We've seen this dynamic in action for a long time when it comes to SROs, or single-room occupancy buildings. They're the residential hotels you see mostly in neighborhoods like the Tenderloin and Soma and in downtown Oakland. These are homes for people that would often otherwise be homeless, but the struggle to keep them that way is ongoing. Owners are finding ways to market them to higher paying guests, travelers, international students. In response, San Francisco Supervisor Aaron Peskin is proposing a tightening of SRO regulations. In Oakland, the City Council is working for the first time to create some of the protections that San Francisco's had in place since the 80s. To learn more about life inside these homes, we're airing profiles of SRO residents all this week. Here's our first one.
My name is Kevin Watkins. I live in the Mission at the Star Hotel. And the one thing I would like people to know about me is that if they only handed me $1, everything would be A-OK. I was closeted, homosexual, and had been in the closet my whole life, to thoughts, to deeds, everything. Really wanted to be a straight person very badly.
wanted to be normal, just wanted to be a regular person. I was fortunate, I kind of fell into the computer field when I was a young man, and I started out in operations and went into programming and went into system controls, and was just really lucky to be, you know, on the street at the time when people were going from mainframes to PCs. So I was very lucky, and I'd gotten laid off twice in a two-year period, and I could kind of see the writing on the wall. I had no formal education. I had a GED, that's what I had. So I decided that I would take this opportunity to go to college. I studied education, I got a teaching degree, and so I ended up going to a church's school. You know, I loved it, I was very good at it. I totally loved it. I loved doing it, but I was in the closet. And someone came to me one day and they said that this particular student had committed suicide. I knew why he had done it without them even telling me, because he was gay and his parents were bullying him. I felt that that boy would not have killed himself if he had known he'd had a gay teacher, and a good teacher, and a teacher that liked him and that was smart. So I was asked to speak at the funeral, and I decided to come out of the closet at the funeral, and I was never allowed to return to the classroom. I became homeless. Well, I gave it 2 years on the street, still looking for work. You know, I couldn't teach for the state, so I was really limited in the sort of parochial type schools that I could apply to. I only did that for about a year. Eventually you get to the point where you look like you're homeless. You smell like you're homeless. And so I gave up. I gave it another year on the streets, and then I attempted suicide. And through a series of short-term programs and slightly longer-term programs, I ended up here. I used to sleep in Dolores Park during the days and walk at night, mostly. I felt safer doing that. I slept up there a few times at night, but you could get hassled by cops or by other people. So I found it was just better to walk. I used to walk in the financial district because it was well lit. And then sleep, you know, during the mornings and afternoons at Dolores. What I traded, my closets, I traded reality for the gay closet, right? So now I'm really in the closet about how dreadful my situation is, how impoverished I am. It's a word I never thought I would apply to myself. And I came from, you know, absolute poverty, abject poverty. And I try to be hopeful in spite of all that. You know, I try to think, maybe I can still find love. Maybe I can still find joy. Maybe I can know what love really is. You know, I want to be that guy that's giddy, that says, look, my toes are hardly touching the pavement. You know, I want to know if that's real or if that's just in cartoons. I've never truly experienced that I'm in love feeling. And I don't think that either of the two women that I was with for a long time and completely loyal to did either. So I've got a good friend. We say we love each other, but it's not, I don't really know what love is. I lost all of my acquaintances except for two friends that, out of hundreds of people, I would have sworn were my friends, that I could show up at their door at night, and you know, they'd take me in and feed me and you know, love me. But no, just two people. And it's interesting because it's the two people that were the only two people that I ever confessed to. Those two that I told that to are the only ones that remained my friends. It's always been kind of in my mind, like maybe I should have told more people.
That piece was produced by Colin Peden as part of a partnership with the San Francisco Department of Supportive Housing. You can hear more profiles of SRO residents all this week right here on Cross Currents. And that's it for the show today. Our team includes Leela Day, Olivia Henry, Jürgen Klemm, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Kavalroop Singh, Andrew Stelzer, and Bowen Wang. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Night Mom. The singer, Nick Gomez Hall, was one of the victims of the ghost ship fire. He was from Coronado, he was 25, and he was loved. We've linked to some of his published writing on our website, kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.